Well, of course, I learned about the looting watching CNN with everyone else in the world and was really upset and shocked by that. And a few weeks later, I got a phone call from I was actually traveling for the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, where I'm a curator, and our assistant called and said, "Corey, the Army is looking for you." They had called my office, and when I called them back, they said, "We'd like you to go to Baghdad. How soon can you leave?"
What kind of preparation can you do before you get to Baghdad? Do you get a status report of what has been looted, what the museum looks like, the physical shape?
I didn't have very much information, actually. I did contact colleagues at the Archaeological Institute of America. I tried to talk to as many people as I could. I talked to people who were in the unit who had who was already in Baghdad to try to get a sense from them of what they might need, what to bring. But it's kind of like once you leave, you're almost it's almost like going to the moon. Once you deploy, you're there, and then it gets a lot harder to communicate back home, et cetera, for a while anyway. It was that way.
Obviously, I think almost everyone who hears our conversation will understand why it's important, what loss of cultural or archaeological items can mean. But if you are a nation and other people are coming in to occupy, live, whatever verb you want to use, and they see part of their culture being destroyed, that can be devastating and quite frightening, right?
Well, it was really devastating for Iraq to lose so much of their cultural heritage. At the Iraq National Museum, it's really the flagship of the nation. For us, it would be like the Smithsonian being looted, the Smithsonian Museum of American Art, or the Crystal Bridges Museum here. So much important part of our identity is there. And so people were very upset and devastated by that. And I think that it was very detrimental to the relationship with the United States that things became that unstable to allow for that the looting to take place. The museum was looted by Iraqis, but the point being that the stability needed to be there really early on, and we didn't have that.
If you go back to that phrase we hear so often, winning hearts and minds of people. And I would imagine one way to at least partially win hearts and minds is to protect the cultural and architectural treasures.
Right. Heritage is really critical to that hearts and minds ideal, and you want to show people that you respect their heritage, you respect their history, and you're there to help. And so once you lose that first impression that you do care about the history, it's really hard to get that back.
You literally wrote the book about cultural property and how it can be protected.
Well, I helped write.
Okay.
The
you literally helped write the book.
I literally helped write the Department of the Army manual about protection of cultural property during armed conflict, and it's a civil affairs guide. And it just gave very basic, quick and dirty information about first aid for culture, basically. And that's been in print since right after I came back from Iraq, so about 2004. And it's been reprinted twice since then. And we hope that it'll continue to be updated and soldiers will have that information available.
What kind of first aid do you put in? I mean, if I have a first aid book at home, it tells me how to do the Heimlich. It tells me, you know, how to tie a tourniquet. So what are some of the basic things you had to put in this manual?
Well, protecting cultural property is not that different. So it gives guidance on what to look for if you're going to build a military base somewhere, a base of operations. You want to make sure you check with the local cultural heritage officials if they're there. You want to make sure you're not building on an archaeological site, because that can get really expensive later, and it can also get people really angry if you're destroying cultural heritage. You want to understand where the cultural sites are if there's something like an aerial bombing operation, because we do have certain international obligations to protect cultural heritage against damage during an armed conflict. So all of these things, this booklet, this guide for military personnel, kind of gives an overview of the kinds of things we have to worry about, how to handle paintings, how to use a form called Object ID to keep track of inventories of objects. Make sure you photograph objects if you're dealing with evacuating things out of a damaged building, et cetera, et cetera. So just guidelines to use for the layperson who may not be an expert in cultural heritage.
I can imagine a situation where you might have some resistance from someone who says, well, you know what? These are armed conflicts, and the first thing we're talking about are bullets and bombs. And if I don't, or people I'm in charge of don't instantly recognize that this vase or this column or this painting is culturally, that's okay because we've got to take care of lives first.
Well, and of course, always when you're in the military, you know, progressing the conflict is your job. That's what the military does. However, there are guidelines and humanitarian law and international conventions that the United States has agreed to be part of, and we in the military have to follow the guidelines set forth. So we have a legal obligation, and that includes humanitarian response, the Geneva Conventions, how you treat prisoners of war, and it also goes over into the 1954 Hague Convention, which requires that we pay attention to cultural heritage, even in an armed conflict. And there are some exceptions for what's called military necessity, but overall, you do need to educate yourself and your troops about the guidelines and understand what you're up against.
When you look at history, from Genghis Khan to the Crusades to the Nazis in World War II, there are plenty of examples of how not to protect, how cultural heritage was not protected, how things were looted. Are there any armed conflicts in history that give an example where it was done correctly?
Looting or
protecting? Or protected. I mean, where perhaps an invading force paid attention to cultural heritage? Uh-huh. It seems so counterintuitive to me that would be.
In World War II, the United States and its allies did do a very good job of putting together teams. They were called the Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives teams. And they were fewer than 100 in all the combined Allied militaries. And they were assigned to carry out that mission, and they did try to recruit from the different parts of the military where they could find cultural heritage experts, paintings curators, architects, designers, people who had experience in cultural heritage, art historians, and they brought them together in these teams to work out on the map for potential bombing in Europe and for the invasion of Italy, just for one example, to point out to the commanders where these important sites were, medieval cathedrals, museum collections, important historic city centers, and to try to avoid damaging them when possible. Because, again, it's a hearts and minds thing. There was a media campaign going on back and forth between the Nazis and the Allies of who was going to cause the most damage to the world's cultural heritage in Europe.
Did you have a typical day when you were in Baghdad? I mean, would you show up with like an attaché and go to work in this?
Well, I kind of did have a typical day. Most days we would go to the big palace, Saddam's palace in the Green Zone. We had an office there. We were a group of international. We had not only my group of civil affairs soldiers, we had a small arts and monuments team, but we also had colleagues there from the Italian military and from the Italian Ministry of Culture. We had colleagues from the United Kingdom, from the British Museum working with us. And on a typical day, we would put everybody together in a two-vehicle convoy, drive to the museum. When things were pretty stable in Baghdad, I would stay there all day long working with colleagues at the museum. We also had a few colleagues from the United States working closely with us. Dr. John Russell was one of our advisors. He's an archaeologist. But then as things got less and less stable in Baghdad through the summer and fall of 2003, it got harder. I couldn't stay there by myself. It just, people didn't feel like it was safe. And ultimately, it got really difficult to go to the museum on a regular basis. But we would also try to travel to other cultural sites in Baghdad to check on their condition, talk to members of the Ministry of Culture. It didn't stop just with museums and archaeological sites. We also, at the time, the ministry also included tourism. So I got to go to a lot of meetings about tourism in Iraq. So it was, you know, every day was different and every day was really exciting and interesting.
A lot of responsibility.
It was. It was a little bit of an overwhelming responsibility. And the really difficult thing that I've ran up against is that I thought that there would be more international help, like, say, from the Blue Shield. And I had heard of the International Committee of the Blue Shield that was formed to assist in implementing the Hague Convention worldwide. And I thought that they might have a team there, just like humanitarian organizations send teams during armed conflicts and natural disasters. But I found out the reality is that they didn't really have the capability. They're a very new organization, very small. They didn't actually have any paid staff. And they couldn't send a team. UNESCO did send a team, but the conditions were such and too unstable that they weren't even allowed to stay by UNESCO. They just did a quick day-long survey of the museum, and they left. Hmm. And that was very early on. And then after the bombing of the UN headquarters, they left altogether. There was no UN presence in Baghdad. So I realized that the Blue Shield, as this upholder of the Hague Convention, I thought it should be stronger. And it was during all this time I learned that the U.S. was not even a state's party to the 1954 Hague Convention. And some of my Italian colleagues suggested to me that perhaps we might want to think about becoming a state's party to the Hague Convention, and that maybe if we had a stronger presence of Blue Shield, that we could get some cultural heritage colleagues to talk to members of the Senate about ratification, and that's what we did.